This is the Relics Audio Hour.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of the Relics Audio Hour. I'm your host, Jesse Lauder. The bassist-drummer combo, otherwise known as the rhythm section, is the bedrock of all popular music. Without it, there is no groove. Without groove, there is no joy. And without joy, why even listen to music? From Paul and Ringo to Sly and Robbie to Benny Benjamin and James Jamerson of the Funk Brothers, there are many great rhythm sections that have been examined over the years. In this episode, I wanted to delve into what the secret ingredients are to a successful marriage of bass and drums by pairing two legends of rhythm, but from two completely different bands. Nevertheless, two of our nation's most celebrated bands, George Porter of the Meters and Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. Mickey and George have a long-standing friendship and history of playing together, and did so at this past year's Lockin' Festival, where I conducted this interview. They also have a long history with Relics magazine. To tell you more about that, I'm going to pass the mic to Relics' editor-in-chief, Dean Budnick. Take it away, Dean.
Thanks, Jesse. Two of our favorite artists were on hand at this year's Lockin', Mickey Hart, who appeared with Dead & Company, and George Porter Jr., who appeared with Foundation of Funk. And, of course, Mickey Hart also appeared with Foundation of Funk during one of the most entertaining sets of the weekend. Both of these musicians have graced the cover of Relics. Mickey most recently with Dead & Company in April 2017, and George with The Meters in September 2011. And don't tell anyone, but I suspect that both of these artists will be back on our cover in 2019. As for the current issue, it features the Relics 44, a special section devoted to the people, places, and things that inspire us today. You can find that issue on newsstands, and you can subscribe at relics.com. While you're there, you can also sign up to receive our monthly newsletter, as well as the Relics Daily 7, which compiles the best of jambands.com and relics.com and delivers it to your inbox.
As a side note, you are currently listening to Posthuman from Robert Walter's 20th Congress new album, Spacesuit. You'll be hearing more about the making of this record from Robert himself later in the episode. Additionally, the Relics Audio Hour is a part of the Osiris family. Osiris connects you with podcasts, videos, and live experiences about the artists and topics you love. Visit osirispod.com for more information. Now to take it back. I met up with Mickey and George on Mickey's bus backstage at Lockin', where Mickey kicked off the festivities by blasting one of his all-time favorite, George Porter grooves.
Oh, hey!
Yeah! That's it. That's it, George. That's it. It was stealing. That bass line is the funkiest bass line I ever heard. Do 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 do. I mean, I could listen to that every day of my life. That's such a great record. It's called Destitively Bonnaroo. I remember you say that it fell through the cracks. What do you mean?
I think Mac and the record label wasn't getting along. I think the record label just kind of dropped the ball on it, on purpose, I guess, you know.
That happens. That's the age old story.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, you had to kind of dance when the record label said dance, you know.
You had a few of those experiences yourself, right?
Yeah. But that particular record, was that really special when you made it? Or did you know that it turned out that way for me?
Well, you know,
how'd you feel?
When we did the tracks, you know, because actually, you know, we did those tracks and then we were shipped back out on the road and we didn't hear the finished product. You know, we didn't even, the tracks had scratch vocals when we were doing it, you know, so we didn't hear this record until almost 6-8 months later, you know, when we heard the song, they heard the whole record say, oh, wow.
Now this was produced by Alan Toussaint.
Right.
And this is before, was this before you were working as the meters?
No, we were the meters.
You were back in
We were Alan's rhythm section back then at that time.
I see.
So we were doing all of Alan's sessions back then.
Yeah.
He did like Robert Palmer too.
Did Robert Palmer's, Patti LaBelle.
Right. Yeah. Well, my first question is actually for you, Mickey. You studied and collected rhythms from all over the world. Talk to me about the rhythms of New Orleans and how the sounds of New Orleans influenced you.
Well, interesting. The big takeaway from the rhythms of New Orleans is that they're echoes of the rhythms of West Africa from Nigeria. Now, you have to remember the 400 years of slave trade. So remember, slave trade went to Bahia, then it went through Brazil, up through Central America, and wound up in Haiti, Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Caribbean. And then there was this free slave revolt at the end of the 70s, 1700s. And then everything went to New Orleans, okay? So with those bodies, those expendable bodies, as they would say, there came the music. And that was infused in the music that was already there. And it turned in, it was trance music. It was about the Orishas, the saints. So it came to the West. It was Catholicized. Same gods, just different names, but they were all trance-based religions, backbeat. So that's how the backbeat got to, you know, the strong backbeat got to America. So then it festered there in a place called Congo Square. Yeah. And also then it was a place called Storyville where a lot of jazz was coming up in that place. And then those rhythms were taken to the world through the Mississippi, you know, the riverboats. Gamblers took it up, Chicago, you know, New York, Philly. That's how it was spread.
So the rhythms and the sounds of New Orleans, when did that come into your life? When did you start listening to?
I started listening to meters.
Yeah.
You know, I started listening to, you know, first of all, I was listening to that music, some of the recorded music of the indigenous peoples. And so that was the hint of it. You know, it was all in that stew when it came together with America. And then really caught on when these guys came on the scene and I was able to hear it in a funky, Western way. And it worked and it was just slithering. You know, I couldn't get rid of it. I mean, even if I wanted to, it was in my head all the time. It was rolling around. And then this record hit, this Destinatively Bonnaroo in 74, and that just nailed it shut.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I became riveted in that, even though we were playing it before that.
Yeah.
We were playing the second line music, on. We played Iko. I don't remember when we started playing Iko.
Sure. Do you remember the first time you heard the meters?
I heard it, I think, on this record. It may have been the first. I don't remember actually what the first one was, but I remember the one that got me. And that's, Destinatively Bonnaroo.
Yeah. Yeah.
What records did you make before that, George?
Well, we had meters, had recorded, by the time we did Destinatively, we had done two records. No, we had done three records. We had done the Sissy Strut record.
Right.
We did the Look Up Higher project was the second album. And then Strutting was the third album.
Right.
Destinatively Bonnaroo was, Right Place, Wrong Time came after the Cabbage Alley record. So that's four records we had done. And then while we were recording the Rejuvenation, we went and did this record.
Well, we're here at Lock In where you guys are about to play a set celebrating 50 years of the meters. I want to wish you congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Any reflections on that right now, 50 years? I know, Mickey, you celebrated a 50th anniversary of your own with a band that you play with, but 50 years of the meters is a pretty incredible thing.
50 years. I mean, you sit back and think about it. I always think about it. I remember a little guy named Cousin Joe, told me a long time ago, he said, "Damn, Porter, if I knew I was going to live this long, I took better care of myself."
You don't think 50 years. You know, you just think day by day. When you're back there, you just... eating a lot of spaghetti and living together.
Yeah, and crazy, you know?
No.
But, you know, musically, when you see our songs still, you know, some of our songs are still existing. You know, like the night before last at the Capitol, you know, I talked Zig into playing some tracks that we had never played together as a band.
Meter songs,
yeah.
Never played live.
You know, and it was like.
Which tunes?
Same old thing. was one of the songs. And
first time played last night in 2018.
2018, the first time that Zig and I, as a rhythm section, played that song. All right. Since we recorded, and that was recorded back in 1968, maybe.
Wow, wow, wow.
So, you know, playing some of that music today is and you know, it's like we think of it differently, but the fact that you know that. That music, when we started playing it, the people out there knew what we were doing. It was like, they knew the song.
Right.
And I know you guys reach back and play, play stuff like that all the time. Y'all probably did it a lot more than most people do.
Oh, yeah.
Because y'all played more gigs, you know.
We did play a lot of shows, yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, it was like, you know, for the Meters or members of the Meters, you know, I mean, you know, we just, you know, we hadn't played as a band together until 2000. And in 2000, the idea was to play the hits.
Right.
Or to play the songs that, you know, were close to being hits, right. You know. And so, you know, out of 100 some odd songs, we selected 20 songs and that's what we played, you know.
Mickey started talking about how he discovered you guys. Do you remember when you first heard Mickey play drums or when you started hearing the Grateful Dead or?
No, I don't remember when that happened. What struck me really strong was I believe it was Steve Kimmock, who called me. Or introduced me to Mickey to come out to California and do a date in San Francisco. I don't forget how it is. Kimmy called me, then maybe Mickey called me directly himself, but it was like, I got a heads up that, you know, that this was coming.
Right, right.
And I played that gig in San Francisco. And,
this was in like 2008, when you guys toured together or?
Well, I think the tour came later, you know, maybe 6 months later or something, 4 or 5 months later. You know, what happened is I had to dig in and start learning songs that I'd never heard before, right. You know, cause there were a few songs that I was aware of, you know, but, I want to give you love. There were probably 5 or 6 dead songs that I knew, you know, or had relationships somehow, you know. But there were tons of songs that I didn't know, you know, Bertha and all those tunes like that. I'd never heard them, you know.
What was your impression of the music when you started learning it?
Well, when I was learning it, I had a different approach to the bass line because I just thought that I thought about it when I said, man, they got bass players out there that play more like that record than me. Why me? You know, because I just never thought that, you know, I was more pocket player than another melody maker, you know, and Phil was a melody maker as well as, you know, as a bass player. So to me, when I listened to those tracks, I always just heard, you know, everybody in different places, but nobody on that kick drum.
On the root, right.
On the root of the stuff,
the root,
you know?
Song. It wasn't like that. Phil played all around it.
He played all around it. Yeah.
And I was his style.
Where the hell is one?
Well, the one is, we used to say the one is where you find it.
Well, you find it. And, playing with Mickey was like, I was able, what was the drummer name? Reyes?
Yeah. Daniel Reyes.
He had a pretty strong backbeat that, you know, for me was easier to play on that backbeat, you know, and, you know, me being, you know, being the player that I am, I like being in the pocket with the drummer.
Sure.
That's, I always find that's home plate, you know, yeah. You know, the closer I play to the bottom end of the drums, the better, and stay out the way of the backbeat. You'll never hear a note from me that's on a backbeat.
Right.
The backbeat speaks for itself.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. That's one of the great things about him. And, it allows you to rock easy, you know, and get into a deep groove playing like that, that style of playing, which I love. You know, Phil's got a great style. You can't imagine what he's going to play. He's so unpredictable and amazing. And this George, it's a different animal. It's a whole different thing. And it goes for a different kind of groove. So I enjoyed it tremendously.
Yeah, it's something that I think would be good for, you know, young listeners who are maybe musicians learning how to play drums and bass. Talk to me about your thoughts on the bassist drummer relationship. I mean, you know, I've heard some people call it the battery, but you know what?
The battery.
I've heard the that. Battery. The battery that fuels, you know, that drives the band. Well, that's absolutely true. It does drive the band. As the drummer goes, so does the band. As the groove goes. If you don't have the groove right and nothing to build on, that's the foundation. Yeah.
The foundation.
That's the foundation of everything. If there's no groove, there's no rhythm, well, then you're just playing free. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But that is not groove music. And we were playing groove music. And so, that's pretty well, you know, the story between bass and drums have to be like one, but they're not. They're both, they're singular as well. So they're both things. Sometimes they're in the groove and then sometimes you take liberties. You know, with grace notes and all kinds of fills and things like that, but it always landed on the one and the three and this and that. You always give them preference to the on beat,
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the drummers and percussion, we take care of the off beat and then we fill in all over. But our primary focus is backbeat, as George so well pointed out. So that's a very symbiotic relationship. If you don't have that, you ain't holding anything.
And I've always loved the fact that, you know, when you know, and it's been my working knowledge of the relationship between bass and drums is that when it's time for the drummer to be busy, then the bass finds a smaller part to play in order for that space to be allowed, you know, to be as busy as he wants to be,
right.
You know, and the other thing is this, that the smaller my part is, and as far out as the drummer wants to go, he always have a home to come to,
right.
Because I'm staying at home. You know, I think that our jobs between bass and drums is somebody always has to stay at home. You know, sometimes it's even more pocketed when both of us are at home.
Right.
But then when one of us has to go off, somebody is at home, you know, and that's my job. It's, you know, I see that as being my job.
See, in the Grateful Dead, we have two drummers. So we have home covered.
Right.
Even when we go away on little side trips, there's always something that tells you where it's at. Now, Bill and I have the ability to not play the one many times.
Sure.
We've studied that and played together over the years, learning from North Indian classical music, which I was taught from Alarakan Zakir Hussain, all the drummers that I played with. They describe it as you're just flying over the groove. You know where the one is, but you don't have to hit it. It's kind of silent. And then you leave that go for as long as you want. And then, of course, then, like George says, you come home. So there's the ability to fly over and just like watch the groove pass below you,
mm-hmm.
and then drop in on the one when you want it,
mm-hmm.
and then come off of the groove. Then that allows the music to breathe and fly. Too much of the one, 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 one. If you don't make variations, they could become boring.
Yeah.
And so, you have to have the ability, like George. George does that. So he has the ability to not make it boring, even though it's redundant. And redundant is good because redundancy is the basis of trance. So we play trance music. It's really the basis of all this. And then we make words over the top of it and so forth.
Sure.
But the groove is trance grooves.
When you guys play together, what would you say you guys learned from each other?
I learned that George doesn't like a cold bus. You know, that's the big thing I took away. Remember, George?
Yeah.
George would be there in a hoodie. And I like it cold. So, you know, you stay awake and everything. And so I try to, you know, I came back a little bit from my, you know, from the ice cooler.
Ice cooler.
What you call it. And so George was always there with a hoodie. I said, George, I'm so sorry. He said, oh, don't worry.
It was a thermal hoodie. It wasn't just a hoodie. It had a thermal lining.
That's what I learned from George.
Now, I think beautiful. Musically, it was, for me, it opened more doors to seeing outside of my thinking totally, you know, because like I said, the music, you know, although I kind of most of the majority of the time I found a pocket in an agreement with the drummers,
mm-hmm.
I also learned that there was room for me to go around things and play some of those things, those thoughts that was used by Phil so often, you know, just not as often, you know. And I mean, so it was a schooling of another thing, because, you know, there was a lot of those songs that, you know, didn't really work as well with a straight ahead pocket. Yeah. You needed, you know, because the melody line, you know, I mean, I've sang about four of them now, four of these songs. And I've learned that, as a person who's singing these songs, that, you know, there's things that you just can't do.
Right.
You know, and one of those things is like play more notes than need to be, you know, like Sugar Reed for me, is more like a shuffle, you know, like a nice strong, you know, one of those old R&B shuffles, you know,
yeah,
on the bass line, you know, I play that kind of, that shuffle bass line, and, you know, I can sing all of the words without problem, you know.
George kind of turned out to be a hybrid of all of this. You know, we took him to the dark side. Yeah, we took him to the dark side.
It's I have a question from a friend named Robert in Claremont, California, who actually asked for Mickey, what's it like for you to play straight? And for George, what's it like for you to play out?
Straight's good. I mean, a groove is good. I like to do both. That's the kind of drummer I am. I love the groove. And I also love to fly above the groove and do all kinds of embellishments and, you know, like airs above the groove, you know, and colors and little visitations to different places. Think of it like a bumblebee going from flower to flower pollination, you know, and I pollinate. And then when I pollinate and people will hear that and they do that, and then I go to another flower. And that's how I do. I just like, and, you know, and I don't really repeat that much. I mean, I slightly alter. It just happens. That's the way I work, you know, as opposed to Bill, he will stay in the pocket. He is the pocket. He's the very dead center of the band. So it has to be one person.
He's the kick drum.
He is the absolute dead center of the Grateful Dead or Dead and Company, whatever you call it. So everybody marks time around. That's the signpost, you know, of the rhythm. And how well you move all around that is how well the band goes and the music progresses. Now, Bill, he's a hybrid too.
Yeah.
See, Bill, over the years, he'll let go and we'll fly and we'll go to other places. And that's where it became a jam band when, you know, we started to be able to not worry about the one. Remember, we were taking a lot of psychoactive drugs at that time.
Sure.
And we were playing together. And so we were elastic. And so our groove was very snake-like. Our groove expands and contracts just like a snake. And it's not straight. We don't do perfect time. We never did, nor do we ever want to.
Yeah.
It's different. Even though it seems straight, it has a certain kind of elasticity to it. And it just breathes in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And in all these places, and after the years, we know how to breathe together. So it's all about that inner breath that makes our groove different than all other grooves is the relationship between me and Bill and how we treat that straight time.
Right.
It's kind of a love affair you have with the groove. You know, you love the groove but you want to get outside it a little bit and experience the other part, you know, the other things that the groove does not provide, which it allows you to fly to other time signatures.
Sure.
And it's not so well stated. So you can make up stuff as you go in the groove. You anticipate the one, you know where the one's going to come. So you, it's kind of like, you know where home plate is, as George says. And so you count on it. And that's that kind of music. There's another kind of music where you can't count on it, which we love. we definitely love, but we are a group band and trance band as well. So we turned out to be both, you know, and I came back with all that Indian music stuff,
sure.
You know, learning things like playing the band like in 10.
Yeah.
I composed in 10. I composed, and,
11.
11. Yeah. You know, I did the 11 and all kinds of stuff that were out of the 4/4 pocket thing. So I started doing 7s, 10s, and 11s, and 12 against 11, and 11 against 12, and all kind of these little tricks that we do in our music, which sometimes you don't even know what it is.
No, it's there, right.
You don't even know it is, exists, yeah. But we're doing these little tricks, you know, these old Jedi tricks all the time. And we're entertaining ourselves. Me and Bill have this we have this conversation going for over 50 years. So we want to keep it fresh all the time, you know, and surprise each other. So we'll do that all night and have a very happy conversation, rhythmic conversation. And then we give it to the band. And then the band picks up on it. And then we have conversations with the band. But first we have to get it.
The right. Conversation between each other. Correct.
Yeah. We got to get home plate. And yeah. then we invite others in and they invite us into their.
It's unbelievable how to imagine how playing together for 50 years, you know, that keeping it fresh, keeping it opening, you know. I mean, that's just, I mean, when I sat in with you guys in New Orleans that night, that was the first time I got to see the two of you play together.
Yeah.
Live.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, I was sitting there saying it and I'm saying to myself, I said, I understand this, you know, I absolutely understand, you know, what I had been fighting somewhat for years, you know, trying to figure out which one of these guys I should listen to. You know, when I'm playing the part, where should I get? You know, I mean, whose pocket should I be into? And, you know, and it was like, oh, yeah, okay. But, you know, but playing with them, I found that what I do, you know, works either way.
Right.
I can get right in the middle and, you know, and, you know, and it's like home, you know.
And
like,
he can get let go, and he can let go, and that's honored.
Yeah.
In our world.
In your world, yes.
In our world, not necessarily in his world. See, you can't be going out spacing out on, you know, second line stuff. Yeah. That's a certain classic form, but we don't have a classic form. Our classic, we made our own classic form,
which is
a combination of other things. His form is part of it, but there are other forms that we brought in, and it was kind of a hybrid as well. You know, it's a combination of the world's music processed through the Grateful Dead's mind, you know, and the music that we were trying to play, which was, you know, which was a free music. It had a freedom to it. And then we incorporated that freedom and we tried to make, you know, groove songs out of it.
You also, I mean, you guys incorporated funk at a certain point, though. I mean,
Of course, great big funky band.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, can you pinpoint when that happened? Was it listening to Dr. John or was it another time?
No, I think that it was a blues band, remember?
Yeah, sure.
And the blues are funky. And, you know, some of the blues songs became, you know, what I call funky.
Yeah.
And little by little, you know, some of it we just left behind. And some of it we just picked up and made it into our own world.
Right.
That's what you do. Thing is, when you learn music, you usually base it on some body of work that precedes you.
Sure.
And in our case, it was country music and bluegrass and the blues. It was a blues band. And then you learn that style and you learn your instrument. Remember, everybody's just learning their instrument at that time. And then you find your own voice in that. Then it becomes your own. After a while, you don't play what you heard, but what you now took from that and made it your own.
Right.
And that's how music progresses. That's when music dies and then new music is born.
Right.
Just because of that. That's why archives and the music that came before you was so important, because everybody needs a light to go, to shine, to find your way when you're making your own music or when you're finding your instrument, you're finding your relationship between you and your instrument. That's a critical time. First of all, you got to pick the right music to listen to.
Right.
But that's important. You know, if you're following the wrong trail, then you wind up dead end.
Kind of on this, in our greater topic of bassists and drummers, any favorites of the great rhythm sessions that come to mind? I mean,
well, Ziggy's, of course, you know, Ziggy's is Zig, you know, and then there's Willie Green, you know,
Gene
Willie Green. Yeah, Willie Green. He's fine for me. Now, what do you say, George?
Well, I mean, I think it was, I kind of, the guys that came before Zig for me was, you know, Smokey Johnson and, I'm going to be calling him Junie Boy. They had that New Orleans pocket that Zig grew out of.
Yes.
He's a student of that school. That, you know, he took it to the next step because, you know, where they were as percussionists and drummers, Zig incorporated that street thing that the brass band guys
right.
was doing. You know, that's right. thing. He brought that into that mix and made it like what a brass band would do with two players. With one player, you know, and Zig did that better than anybody I know.
He did. So. He did. That was, he was a masterstroke. It's totally singular.
Elvin Jones, Jimmy Garrison, for you guys. I mean, I think of them oftentimes when I listen to some of the early improvisation of the Grateful Dead. I mean, were you guys, Coltrane, obviously, I know, being a big influence.
Yeah, Elvin was a big, you know, Elvin became a big influence. You know, I came out of the Gene Krupa kind of style. That was my, mentor kind of, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going into that heavy on the tom-toms, dance band stuff, you know, backbeat.
Yeah, wow.
And, power drummer.
You played in big bands. Did you play in big bands when you were a kid?
No, I didn't. I played a couple of gigs that were, you know, like around what they call Mardi Gras time, you know, they had,
sure.
But it wasn't considered a big band, but it was like the union required that you have 14 pieces on stage. And so that was, you know, I did that, you know, but it wasn't considered a big band, you know, and unfortunately I never had, you know, I didn't listen to my dad listened to lots of jazz. I listened to street music, you know, because they were around my house. There was somebody dying every week. And every time somebody died at that social pleasure club, there was a second line. Mm-hmm. So, I got to hear second line music all the time. And the radio station in New Orleans played New Orleans music. So I heard the Earl Kings, the Snooks mm-hmm. Eaglins, mm-hmm. the Eddie Bowles, and then, you know, the Ernie Cato's and those guys, Allen Toussaint, you know, and Lee Dorsey. And I got to play with those guys later in life, you know, which was, I have my bass player influences was a young man that nobody knew. His name was Benjamin Francis. He was just a guy sitting on the steps with his grandfather that was an excellent musician, you know.
Okay. Yeah, well, I played in dance bands and playing Duke Ellington and Count Basie music. I wanted to be the drummer for Count Basie once. That was before I met Kreutzmann, you know, and, I played rock and roll, but when Bill and I got together, that was a whole other world.
You guys like met at a Count Basie?
Met at a Count Basie concert.
Wow.
Actually, we were in the audience. I was hanging out with Sonny Payne, who was the drummer for Count Basie. And we met that night and we hit it off so well that we went all night. We played the city streets, everything in the street. We went around until almost till dawn, playing the garbage cans, playing the light posts, playing cars, playing trash cans, playing the city. And we wound up in a little club called The Matrix, where there was Janis Joplin was playing. The Matrix was just a hallway, like it was just only like about 16 feet wide and about 40 feet long. It was just like a long hallway, and Janis and the band were at the end, but no stage or anything. It was just like real small. Like you could hardly get the band in there. And we wound up there, and that was the end of, you know, that was it for me. I never heard anything like that. When James Gurley, he grabbed his guitar, he was playing this old Standell amplifier and it had this big spring reverb in it. He was on his guitar and it was in a solo thing. He grabbed the amplifier, pulled it up against his guitar and started jumping up and down like that.
Wow.
And the reverb would go, and then he just let it go.
Yeah.
And it fell on the ground. And then the band walked out and then Janis started screaming over the top of it. And I said, oh boy, this is for me. But Kreutzmann said, you want to hear Fire or Ice? I never heard Janis or Grace in, I said, what do you want to hear? Fire or Ice? I said, I want to hear Fire. So we wound up at the Matrix.
Okay.
And to hear Janis. And then eventually I heard, you know, Grace, who was like, you know, she was Ice.
Janis was fire.
And so, yeah, so that was a wonderful evening. It changed everything.
You know, I feel like in this day and age, you know, there's a lot more and more musicians getting away from playing more programming. I know you've been working a lot on electronic music, mm-hmm. but for, you know, a young bassist and a young drummer looking to get into acoustic music, I mean, any advice on what they should be looking for in a drummer or what they could be doing with rhythm, time, you know?
Well, the most important thing is your heart. You have to follow your heart. You have to find out what appeals to you, what you go to. And then you say, okay, I love that. And then you work your way to that. And, you know, you follow your heart, follow your feeling, follow your feet. That's how you do it. You just have to dig deep and find out in yourself what really resonates with you and what you really love. Cause there's so many styles there and so many drummers are offering all these different versions of the groove. And, you know, you got to find it for yourself, but you have to sort of model it after somebody else. Usually somebody that came before you. In my case, it was Gene Krupa, my first love. Besides, I remember I was listening to Pygmy music when I was 6 years old. You understand? I was listening to the world's music. You know, the Ituri rainforest music when I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. Wow. So I was listening to the world's music. So my ear was stretched plenty good before I even hit, you know, popular music.
One of the things I enjoyed the most thing when I about meeting Mickey is the day he invited me to his home and he took me out in the backyard and showed me his world of percussions, which was like trees and fallen trees, you know, wood that had been floating in the ocean, you know, stuff like that. And that was all very playable, all had wonderful sounds. You know, it was like, I was absolutely blown away. I couldn't, at first I say, this guy crazy.
He crazy. You
know? And then when he go around and started playing on these things, I say, whoa, man, it opened another door for me. I just don't have a yard big enough to put something like that in, you know? I don't have friends that ship me trees from around the world and stuff like that. But it was, man, I tell you, it was, I've always said, you know, there are two things that I learned or I enjoy in my aging period. You know, I'll be 71 this year. And in my aging period, probably the last 20 years, of my life, you know, I got to meet some musicians that, you know, that I sit back and think about, you know, that's been musicians for long, long periods of time.
Well, I'll say this.
Mickey and Bill is just like.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, man, you made my life whole when I heard you, when I heard those bass lines and I met you and we played together. We went on the road. I tell you, that made me whole. I could not be who I am without, you know, hearing what he had done with the bass and the groove. Me being a groove, I love groove, and George treated it really fine. And that meant a lot to me. So the bass always resonates in my.
And I got him into sitting up after the gig and listening to his gig. You know, after every gig that we played on that road, we would sit on the bus. And listen to the gig.
Well, yeah.
He made the bus driver pull over at some Bose place somewhere, and he bought, because he didn't like the way the speakers.
Oh, I bought some Meyer speakers. Yeah, remember doing
that? Yeah, he bought a little stereo system that sounded killing.
There wasn't a little stereo system. It would, it just
kicked. On the bus.
Oh, yeah, I know. It made you move.
It was killing.
Made your spine tingle.
You know, you're saying, okay, that's what the band's supposed to sound like, you know? But we listened to every gig every night, and it was like, as you know, because for me, I was, you know, when I get off the bus, I go plug my little Walkman in and then I
go to the tapes.
I listen to the gig. And I started passing comments at me after the first or second gig. I said, man, you know, this is happening. We need to tell the engineer, we need to bring this in, you know, cause he's not treating certain instruments with the proper respect or some of the stuff like that, you know. I say, you know something, man, and I see you do things on your drums. I don't hear them, you know. So that means that the engineer is not treating that part of your drum kit, you know, with the respect, you know? And he would say, well, we need to hear this. And then he'd make the engineer come in there and listen to this.
Again, you know, I say, okay, here it is.
Yeah, man.
We're painting a picture, you know, and we're painting it as we go. And there's some colors and are missing out of the painting. It's like they're just not there, but they're supposed to be there because there are holes for them. And not just the drums, but other things.
Yeah, sure. Other things.
It was all over the place. So we had to tell, because this was kind of new music. This was hybrid music. So we had to tell him what to be respected and what has to come up and what has to come a little bit back.
Sure.
And just the overall tone of our parts being able to lock together and integrate, because we were playing integrated parts, not just one part just going all the way across
would
to the
you,
other
would
part.
Would you go back like to that. Dead tapes after a Dead show?
We used to.
Yeah.
In the old days, we used to sit down and really, we would listen to all the hours, and they were longer than 3 hours.
Yeah, you know, five-hour gigs.
Yeah, at least, you know, we played from dawn to, you know, from dusk till dawn, you know, so. But we didn't listen to those tapes, but we listened to it. So that became a rule. We actually listened to it on the Nagra. It was recorded on. So a lot of those tapes that are, have been released by Dick Spix and so forth.
Recorded on a Nagra machine.
They were all recorded on, most of them were recorded on a lot of them.
Here's your modern Nagra right here. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then we'd bring that Nagra back to the room and play it on the Nagra. Wow. It was recorded on you know, beautiful speakers, you know, Meyer speakers. We had a whole setup and everything. So it was very serious business for us to listen to what we were giving the people.
Sure.
We were really, because we were making it up as we were going along. So, okay, we don't want to, you know, we want to know what we're doing here, because we once you play it, you forget it.
Shortly after our conversation wrapped, Mickey, along with his bandmates Bill Kreutzmann, Bob Weir, and John Mayer, joined George and Zig in the Foundations of Funk on the Lockin stage, playing a set that celebrated 50 years of the Meters. You're currently listening to Hey Pocky Way from that set. Many thanks to Mickey and George for an enlightening and lively conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com. Every time keyboard virtuoso and longtime friend of Relics, Robert Walter, reconvenes his 20th Congress, he delves deeper and deeper into the wellspring of his most formative influences. Hip-shaking soul, 60s and 70s funk, and classic organ jazz. However, for his latest outing, Spacesuit, out now on the Royal Potato Family, Walter switched his source of inspiration from digging through crates to gazing speculatively skyward, imagining new worlds rather than emulating classic records. Here is Robert Walter on the making of his new album.
Hi, I'm Robert Walter, and you've been listening to music from my new album, Spacesuit. For this album, I tried to write music that didn't fit real squarely into one genre or another. That way, when we started to improvise, we didn't know exactly where we were going to end up. The goal was to create something original and personal. The songs themselves just get us started. The music really happens when the band starts to play together and push each other. As well as bringing in some new musical influences, I also got a lot of inspiration from visual sources. In particular, I got excited about a lot of older science fiction, the films of Hordowski, Stanley Kubrick, as well as visual art by Chris Foss, H.R. Giger, and Mobius. I feel like the space imagery is an analogy for us pushing ourselves further while we improvise. As the record goes on, I feel like you can feel us getting further and further away from home. I feel like this album suggests a story rather than tells you a story. So each person can interpret it in their own way, but still feel like they're taking a journey with us.
Many thanks, Robert. You're currently listening to Chalk Giant from Robert's new album, Spacesuit. Be sure to check it out now on the Royal Potato Family. That's a wrap for this episode of the Relics Audio Hour. Once again, I'm your host, Jesse Lauder. If you'd like to learn more about me, you can visit my website, jesselauter.com, or follow me on the good old Instagram at jesselauter. I have several people to thank for making this episode possible. Rhea Hart, Danny Monzo, John Phillips, Mary Beth Ongier, Gopher Dindus Productions, and the staff at Relics Magazine. The Relics Audio Hour is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network. For more info on Osiris, be sure to visit osirispod.com. Thanks again for listening, folks, and be sure to tune in next time to the Relics Audio Hour.